Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, a show created at KALW with the support of listeners like you. As you listen to the programming you value, give your support to KALW's September campaign. Join us for the first time or renew your membership at KALW.org. Thank you. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. It's been almost 15 years since George W. Bush first used the term war on terror. He did it on September 20th, 2001. Since then, the United States has been in a perpetual war. Look at the current state of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the greater Middle East. What has been accomplished? Today's guest, veteran Mark Danner, writes about perpetual war in his new book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And he asks a very important question that we ask on this show, and that is, why do politicians and presidential candidates believe that continuing down the path of drone attacks, raids, and bombing campaigns will result in a different outcome? Why is this question rarely asked in the media? Mark Danner is a veteran journalist who has reported on politics and foreign affairs for more than three decades. He's covered wars and political conflict in Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. Mark is a professor of journalism and English at UC Berkeley. He's the author of several books. His most recent is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And Mark joins us from New York. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back, Mark. As we always do on our media roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your eye this week?
Well, what caught my eye was a series of three pieces in the Guardian newspaper by Spencer Ackerman. The newspaper is British, the reporter is American, and he did a series on the compiling of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee's report on torture, which was an enormously fraught, enormously controversial undertaking that was released, the executive summary of which was released about a week ago, that concluded that torture as performed by the Central Intelligence Agency essentially derived no useful information, no life-saving information, that it was much more brutal than the CIA had admitted, and that the Central Intelligence Agency had repeatedly lied about it, not only to the public, but to its overseers in the Congress and in the executive branch as well. And Spencer Ackerman did a series of three pieces essentially investigating how the report was compiled and the battle between the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency as that report was being put together. To make a very long and very interesting story short, the CIA ended up hacking the computers of the senatorial committee to find out what they knew and to try to remove documents that they had discovered. And the CIA was eventually denounced on the floor of the Senate by Senator Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat from California, who then was the chairwoman of the Intelligence Committee. And this is a three-part series in The Guardian that's very in-depth for anybody who's not only interested in torture and the war on terror, but also in how the highest levels of national security elites interact and fight one another and struggle within the Capitol during the heyday of the war on terror. This is absolutely essential reading. It's great reporting, and I highly recommend it. Spencer Ackerman in the Guardian.
Mark, you mentioned that in this piece, Spencer Ackerman reveals that the torture that was used was more brutal than we know. Can you tell us about that? Can you give us some of the details?
Yes. You know, during especially during the mid 2004 to 2008, I would say, after the revelation of the photographs from Abu Ghraib prison, there was a veritable waterfall of leaks about torture. And the Central Intelligence Agency in particular, and the military to some extent as well, who controlled Guantanamo, came forward and essentially said, well, you know, this stuff is very measured. There's a doctor present. It's not torture at all. That, of course, was their argument. It is enhanced interrogation. No one is abused in any way. This is very scientifically applied and so on. And when you find the actual documents, as the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence did, from the CIA reporting on what was done, it's kind of a shocking, dark tale of abuse and depravity. I mean, first of all, we were told that waterboarding, which was the harshest single technique, was used only sparingly, but learned actually before the Senate report that it had been applied 183 times to one detainee and 83 times to another. So it wasn't used sparingly at all. We also learned that one detainee who was waterboarded was simply lying on his back, his mouth and nose full of water with bubbles coming out, completely unresponsive. In other words, it had made him unconscious, this prolonged waterboarding. We heard about the use of rectal feeding and rectal hydration, during which enema bag essentially was forced into the detainees' rectums and used in various depraved ways. They were walled, which is means smashing them against the wall. They were laid on a plastic sheet and covered with icy water, sometimes covered with ice, suspended from the ceilings by their hands for day after day, not allowed to sleep for, in one case, 11 days in a row, if you can imagine that. The tale of it is now, you know, any of your listeners can go online and look at the executive summary of this report, which is very, very dark reading. And I mean, the short message here is really the notion that this was all scientific and all, you know, done in this very hygienic, you know, medically approved way is just complete nonsense. It's just not true. And we have a very complete report showing what was done. And it really gives you nightmares. You know, this was a lot of extreme brutality. There's no other way to describe it, I don't think.
And to think that the media were actually having a debate about using the word torture versus enhanced interrogation for
That's
so
true.
Many years.
Well, in for many media outlets, that debate still goes on because, of course, torture in a sense is a word of art, which is to say that it's a legal term as well. The United States is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture, which means that it has signed an international undertaking declaring that torture is illegal and that it will never use it, including during states of emergency and during war. So the Bush administration, one of its stratagems was to essentially say, well, this isn't torture. This isn't torture. It does not rise to the level of torture. And it had some rather complicated and I think obviously specious reasoning to argue that, much of it put together by my colleague at the University of California at Berkeley, John Yoo, who's at Bolt Hall at the law school at the moment. But he was in government and he wrote the requisite memos that argued that this was not torture. So the assertion on the part of the administration was this is not torture. The President Bush, that is, himself said this is not torture. We do not torture. So news outlets were faced with the option of either calling it torture and seeming to editorialize, that is, to take issue with what the president himself said and what the American government had concluded, because indeed the government did conclude this. John Yoo was in the Justice Department, or to adopt a kind of neutral point of view, which, of course, the press is always most comfortable in doing. And that is what the press did. And in effect, that's what most of the press, or a lot of the press, still does. Mm. When waterboarding is carried out by other countries, like China or elsewhere, we call it torture. When we talk about it in the hands of the United States, the Central Intelligence Agency, very often the locution is what some critics call torture. So the word is not used forthrightly and still isn't.
Mark, I'm really glad you brought this piece to our attention. Again, it's a piece by Spencer Ackerman at The Guardian. It's called No Looking Back, the CIA Torture Report's Aftermath. He actually wrote this on 9/11. And I was going to ask you your thoughts on media coverage about 9/11, 15 years after these attacks. Of course, the coverage looked at people's lives 15 years later, where they are today. There was some good coverage about people who are still suffering, first responders, people who were in that area, and how a lot of people now have cancer. They still have problems breathing. So there was some good reporting on that. I didn't see as much reporting looking back at what actually happened and what the Bush administration told the public. What were the facts versus the lies? Did you see much of that?
No, I saw very little of that. And, you know, it's a very odd event. I mean, the press loves anniversaries. It's a way you can get history into the newspaper. But this is a very odd anniversary because, in effect, the historical event of 9/11 is still going on. Mm-hmm. It's not in the past. I mean, the war itself, as you said very eloquently in your introduction, continues. The war is ongoing. People every day are being killed by drones. There are military actions. American troops are fighting in Iraq. They're fighting in Syria. American forces are fighting in Somalia and Yemen. One could name a number of other places as well. And these are the wars of 9/11. So it's somewhat odd to look back at September 11th and consider it as an event that happened that day. I would like to have seen a lot more coverage taking up what's really our central question, you know, in this interview, which is, how long is this war going to go on? Is it going to end? How will it end? And you saw virtually no consideration of that question, even though, you know, we have a presidential campaign in which one of the candidates says he'll destroy ISIS by bombing the blank out of them. I can't use the word on the radio. The other candidate talks about more complicated policy in which she'll create safe areas in Syria and so on. I mean, all of these issues, which are at the center of U.S. foreign policy, are directly connected to 9/11. They're not as if – it's not as if this is separate. It is – we are in the middle of a historical era that 9/11 kicked off. So I find the coverage very odd. It's as if the day has been in some way sacralized, made into this sacred event, and it's divorced from us as this kind of shining moment in history. And it emphatically is not. It's connected to what is going on day by day, what American forces, men and women, are doing abroad. But we seem unable to make those connections. And that's one of the arguments in this book, that the war, even though it goes on, it's faded from people's consciousness, which has partly what has allowed it to become, as I argue, the forever war.
Why do you think that is, Mark? I mean, you make a good point about how what we're dealing with today is directly connected to 9/11, even though President Obama made a conscious decision to stop using George W. Bush's language, the war on terror. He rarely talks about 9/11. But what explains this in the media? Did you watch the Matt Lauer interview a couple of weeks ago of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? I mean, he's getting slammed for asking Hillary Clinton about her emails for about 30 minutes and giving Donald Trump a bunch of softball questions.
Yes, I did. I did, for my sins, watch that interview. It was a very painful interview. I mean, you know, Donald Trump was Donald Trump. He simply was himself. He did a lot of exaggerating, some lying, a lot of blather and bravado. The Hillary Clinton part of the interview was disturbing. As you say, more than a third of it was taken up by questions about her emails in a very short interview supposedly devoted to national security. But, you know, to me, this hour of interviewing was what we get in the campaign when it comes to national security at a time that a war is ongoing is rather shocking. It really is. And you asked what accounts for it, and I don't think one can give a single answer. I think, you know, there is a peculiarity of the news business, which is, as you well know, what makes news is man bites dog, not dog bites man. You know, something unusual, something strange. And when you have a war that's going on for 15 years, it kind of fades off the radar screen as news. It's no longer news. It's also, should be said, that because the war is fought largely with air power, including with unmanned drones, you know, the idea that Americans are at risk every day is somewhat far from people's consciousness. Another aspect of the war is Guantanamo, and what people want to think about the fact that we have 60-odd detainees still kept indefinitely on this island in the Caribbean. Nobody particularly wants to think about that. They're distant figures, and they're the other. You know, they're from another place. They're terrorists. We don't care about them, and so on. So I think in many ways people don't really want to think about this, basically. And the press is in this position of saying, well, what's new about this war? Mm-hmm. Oh, yet another drone attack. You know, it doesn't seem newsworthy at a certain point when it's been going on so long. And the odd thing is that there are events that are part of the war on terror, very dramatic parts. For example, the attacks in Paris is an obvious example in November, almost a year ago. I mean, those attacks got enormous coverage. But they seem to be taken out of nowhere. You know, these strange attacks. Why would they do this? Why do they hate us? Well, the Islamic State thought of these attacks as responses to the bombing campaign that was undertaken by the United States and its allies, including the French, against the Islamic State. Now, this doesn't mean the attacks were justified. They obviously weren't. They obviously were disgusting terrorist attacks on civilians. But the fact is that they think of these as part of the war on terror, of their response to attacks that have struck them. And we, in our coverage of them and our thinking about them, don't even locate them in that mental space. We simply think of them as these kind of eruptions of evil that have no connection to anything. And I think this really does a disservice to the public, this kind of coverage of these things as these solitary eruptions of evil.
Today we're speaking with Mark Danner, a veteran journalist who has reported on these issues for more than three decades. He's the author of many books, including his most recent, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Mark Danner writes, Abu Ghraib did for the Iraqi insurgents what Guantanamo has done for al-Qaeda, embodying in powerful images their arguments about who Americans were, what they did to Muslims, and why they must be defeated. Now, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of these issues? Last week, we had a show about 9/11. We spoke with Kristen Breitweiser, who lost her husband on 9/11. She's one of the Jersey girls who's in the movie 9/11 Press for Truth. And they're the women that asked many, many questions right after their husbands died. If it weren't for them, we probably wouldn't have had the 9/11 Commission report. We also had on Andrew Basevich, who served in the Army for 22 years, and he writes about military intervention and exceptionalism. And today we're speaking with Mark Danner about these issues. So the media focus did a lot of reporting on the anniversary of 9/11. What did you think about it? What stood out for you? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Mark, I have to ask you this question because it just gets more surreal by the day. So now Donald Trump says he believes Obama was born in Hawaii. I got two breaking news alert emails about this. It is leading the headlines on every single outlet. How do you explain this?
Well, you can't make this stuff up. You really can't. The idea that this is an enormous news headline, that Donald Trump has somehow come around to believing that the president was born in Hawaii, I mean, it's kind of beyond parody. Of course, Trump is one of the most prominent, if the most prominent birther advocate in saying that the president was born in Kenya, or at least was not born within the United States. And he has never gone back on that. And, you know, before I came in the studio, I thought the Trump campaign had said that. I didn't know that Donald Trump personally had actually said it. But I think it's very worth remembering that his political profile, his existence as a politician, as a political figure, is really tied inextricably with the birther movement, with this movement that is about denying legitimacy to the President of the United States, and that is, at least to my mind and to the mind of many people, a very thinly disguised appeal to racism. That is, you know, this man is from elsewhere, he's African, he can't be your president, and that on the Republican side, I don't know what percentage of his supporters believe that, but it is very, very high. It's well over half of his supporters believe that Obama was not born in the United States and thus is not legitimate as a president, which, you know, this used to be a very outlier opinion. This was, you know, a way to identify extremists. And in fact, we're talking about the majority of his supporters who believe that. And I'm not sure whether it's a majority of Republicans, but it's a very high number. If it's not a majority, it's close to that. So we're in a pretty surreal political environment at the moment, with a level of polarization and fanciful imaginings about politics that I can't really – I can't think of a parallel time to this within my own lifetime. I can't think of anything close.
How will this go down in the journalism history books?
You mean the campaign itself the birtherism?
The media's coverage of this campaign.
I don't think it'll look very good in retrospect, actually. It's a very odd time for the press. You know, on the one hand, you have a candidate I mean, politicians shade the truth. Politicians lie. This is, you know, part of day-to-day business of journalism and trying to separate those lies out and so on. But Donald Trump is something far, far different than that. He really – the Washington Post, I think it was, who did a study of one of his speeches and, you know, said basically two-thirds or three-quarters of everything he said was not true. I mean, the degree to which he bends the truth and makes things up is such that you wonder how you can cope with it. You can't simply in every paragraph insert a correction. How exactly do you deal with it? And when he's called out – for example, he has said repeatedly that he was against the Iraq War from the beginning. It's been shown not to be the case. There are quotations of him on Howard Stern and on other outlets before the war saying he was for it. But he continues publicly, including on the Commander-in-Chief forum with Matt Lauer that you mentioned earlier, to claim that he was against the war from the beginning. So it makes no difference to him that he is repeatedly contradicted in the press by the facts. He continues to say the same thing. And it's very difficult to know what exactly to do at that point. And the press has another problem, which is it's, you know, the American press thinks of itself as objective, that is, covering both candidates in the same way. And the problem is you have two candidates who, when it comes to their relationship to the truth, are very different. I mean, Hillary Clinton indeed has lied, indeed has misrepresented things. There's no question about it. But the sheer percentage of lies in Donald Trump's daily speech is just kind of unprecedented and makes Clinton pale by comparison. And how do you cover the two of them without seeming to completely favor Clinton? And I think the press essentially has fallen into that trap repeatedly. There's also the fact that a lot of reporters really feel that Trump is kind of an existential threat to the country. And it's made journalism about him, I think, somewhat – well, I don't know what to say. I mean, he's covered in a way that I think in retrospect is not going to look very good.
Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. He teaches journalism at UC Berkeley, and he's author of several books. His most recent is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're joined by veteran journalist Mark Danner. He teaches journalism at UC Berkeley. He has covered wars and political conflict for more than three decades in Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. His latest book is called Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And Mark asks a very important question. We ask this question on the show. Why do politicians, presidential candidates, and so many of the people that we we hear in the media believe that continuing down the path of drone attacks, raids, house raids, and bombing campaigns will result in a different outcome? And why isn't this question asked more often? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any thoughts or questions about media coverage of these very important issues, U.S. foreign policy, and where we are today, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from a listener who's on the road, Pasha in Daly City. Hi, Pasha. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, thank you.
Love your show. And this past week, I read an article about 22 million emails from George W. Bush's administration that went missing between, I think, the years of 2003 and 2009, something like that. They were all on a server that was owned by the RNC. So where's the scrutiny on that? That's what I want to know.
Mark, have you read about this?
I'm afraid I haven't. I didn't know. So that's a very large number of emails that went missing. But no, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that story. And it surprises me that it hasn't gotten more coverage. Is Pasha still on the line?
Pasha, are you still with us? No, she's not.
No.
I just looked this up because a few friends were talking about this morning, and it's 22 million emails according to the U.S. Attorney General. The emails requested as part of a congressional investigation could not be produced because they were not sent on a non-governmental email server. I'm reading this over at a piece in the Huffington Post.
They were not sent on a government
On a non-governmental email server. It goes on to say this appears to be a violation of the Presidential Records Act. The 22 million emails were lost in 2007. Was anyone impeached? No. Anyone prosecuted? No. Were the Republicans up in arms? No. Was Karl Rove calling for anyone to resign? No. Because Karl Rove deleted them, according to the Huffington Post piece.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's fascinating. It's very clear that our record keeping, which is, of course, absolutely vital and inherent in keeping a grip on what exactly the government does and how decisions are made, and is, in a sense, the fodder of history. I mean, that's how you figure out how something like the Iraq War came about. You start with how people were communicating with one another. It's obvious that our record keeping is way out of date. And, you know, the idea that Hillary Clinton could have done this, the idea that the Bush administration could have done this, is outrageous. And it's also deeply saddening to me as a journalist, because the only way one has a hope of understanding how decisions are made, how they really come about, and oftentimes our assumptions about how they come about are simply not true when you look at the primary material. And primary material now, it used to be letters and memos, and now it's emails. And in effect, this means that enormous amounts of vital primary material that help us understand why our government does what it does are being extinguished. And it's very, very worrying.
Mm. Well, Newsweek is also covering this. And Pasha, thank you for bringing this to our attention. We'll put a few links at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Really enjoying the conversation. And just wanted to pose sort of a slightly bigger question. As a citizen, I find that the information is incredible and the access to the information is incredible. And everyone who does work helping us get that information is doing their job to their best abilities. But as a citizen, when we talk to each other, I believe the power is for us to convince each other in the conversation. And the polarization that I feel that comes from both sides, and it's factual information, but it's very polarizing. So for us to be able to start a communication between each other, bring each other closer to the middle, and help us direct our government better and direct our media better, how do we, I know it's a huge question, but do you have any small tidbit of advice on how to help each other?
Well, that is a very large question. I'm not sure it's necessarily, I mean, you know, Chris raises something very important, but I'm not sure that it's necessarily the central question when it comes to what we're talking about here, which is the war on terror. I detail in Spiral the fact that though Obama ran in 2007 and 2008 as the candidate who would stop the war and who would return the United States to constitutional practices, would stop torture, would stop very many other things that the U.S. had done under George W. Bush's war on terror. In fact, he continued much of what had been done before. So we're talking about a kind of bipartisan practice that both Democrats and Republicans have indulged in. I mean, it isn't as if Obama hasn't done some things differently. He has, and my book is largely about that. But he did not put an end to the war. The war continues. And I think to get back to Chris's point, when it comes to how we talk about things, I'm not sure that the war on terror is itself a overheated partisan issue. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not seeing two candidates running for president, one of whom is saying end the war on terror, the other of whom is saying prosecute the war on terror. In fact, there is a kind of agreement, a soft agreement, between the candidates to continue what's been done before. And this was true in 2012 as well. Drones were not an issue. Romney did not attack the president, President Obama, for using drones. He did not say he would stop doing this. So one of the things that is troubling to me is there isn't really a partisan conversation going on when it comes to the war. In fact, you know, the president had submitted to Congress a new authorization for the use of military force because, you know, back to 9/11, we're still using the authorization for the use of military force that was passed a few days after 9/11. It's very out of date. It essentially gives the U.S. permission or the president and the executive branch permission, the military permission to attack those people who were associated with those who planned and executed 9/11, and in fact, we are attacking many groups that, including the Islamic State, that did not exist on 9/11. But when you look at the struggle over the authorization for the use of military force, nobody is struggling simply because they want to stop the war. The Democrats think the new authorization might continue the war too long. The Republicans think it might stop it too soon. And the result is kind of stasis. And it's a stasis that Chris would be familiar with, but it's not about, I want to do this, I want to stop doing this. So this isn't really a partisan argument in the way he suggests. Having said that, you know, the question is an interesting one. I'm not sure he's right. It's very, very large. And, you know, the idea that one could suggest a way to do something about the polarization, I'm afraid I don't feel like I'm in a position to do that. We're at a strange point in history.
I often think the polarization is a media creation because the extremists tend to get the microphone, the loudest people who say the most extreme things. But when you look at issues, I mean, minimum wage, Citizens United, healthcare, so many issues. I mean, 70-80% of the population is really on the same page on those issues. It's just, I think, divide and conquer gets the attention, right?
Well, I think that's true. I think the polarization, there's a sense in which the polarization has to do with the level of political elites.
Right.
I think you have a real point there, that when it comes to policy preferences, there is a lot of agreement among the bulk of the population, which you would think would result in a system that worked efficiently in certain compromises on major issues. I mean, an obvious one, and less glamorous than the ones we've talked about, is infrastructure. Mm. You know, this country simply does not invest in fixing roads, fixing bridges, fixing sewer lines, building new airports. You know, in this, we're talking about trillions of dollars that need to be invested at a time when interest rates are zero and when there's persistent unemployment. And in fact, not only the Democrats are in favor of this, you now have a Republican candidate, Donald Trump, who's in favor of it. Many on the Republican side are in favor of it, and yet it is not. It has not happened because you have this kind of elite polarization. I mean, it'll be interesting if Hillary Clinton is elected to see whether a major infrastructure bill that will put people to work can get through, whether Republicans can, in a sense, overcome their hatred of her and relentless blocking of Democratic policies and let it go through. I mean, if Donald Trump wins, I assume you will have a major infrastructure bill from the Republican side, which is, you know, great irony of our politics.
Hmm. Well, thank you for calling, Chris. Speaking of money, let's hear from our next caller, GS in San Francisco. Hi, GS.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much. My comment is just a couple of parts. The first one is the famous saying, follow the money. If you want to talk about forever war, just talk about forever profit. The arms manufacturers, the ones who make the weapon systems, the aircraft, the armament, the bombs, all of it, it's military industrial work. And that I used to work, not for long, but my first job out of college was in that area. And the way it works is the government says, this is what we need. And, you know, here's the bidding. And then, you know, people shoot their targets, make their targets, you know, for the cost and all. But it doesn't matter whether they meet the goal or if they run over, you know, exceed the budget, they still get paid everything it costs plus 10%. And so I say, just check out where the money is. Follow the money, and you'll see that there's an incredible incentive for people to manufacture stuff that it makes them a lot of money. And the other thing is, it's beat the drum for the population to get all worried and upset and terrified of the bad enemy. You know, it's always that way, propaganda of the government. So I say pay attention to the money and pay attention to, just ignore that man behind the curtain. Look, there's a bad guy over there. And then, boom, we have to fix it. Guess what? We got to pay a lot of money and go kill people.
Well, GS, to your point on money, so Mark, talk about this, because the Obama administration has offered to sell $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia over its 8 years in office. This is according to the Center for International Policy. We recently did a show about this and the Saudi war on Yemen, and they're using U.S.-made bombs and weapons for that. And then on Wednesday, just this Wednesday, the United States signed off on a record $38 billion 10-year military assistance pact with Israel. And the Fiscal Times is reporting that this has major implications for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program. This is a big win for that program. So the U.S. is now going to give Israel even more money, $3.8 billion a year for the next 10 years. What are your thoughts on that and how it's being covered?
Yes. Well, in a sense, both of those things you point to, the Saudi deal and the Israeli deal, are simply increases in the status quo. The U.S. has been rerouting petrodollars, that is, sending money to Saudi Arabia for oil, not just the U.S., but the West in general, and taking those petrodollars back in the forms of arms purchases since the mid-70s. I mean, this was a deal originally worked out by Henry Kissinger in the Nixon and then the Ford administration. And the magnitude of the arms purchases from the Saudis is much larger now, not least because, of course, they're actually using some of the weapons in destroying the neighboring country of Yemen, which is a war that has not been covered very highly. It's a highly destructive war that's killing a great number of people that the U.S. is, in fact, supporting, no question about it. And we're not saying much about it in this country. It's kind of worked its way into the general Cold War that sees the Middle East, in which you have Sunnis versus Shia. The Saudis see the threat from the Shia within Yemen on their borders, supported by the Iranians. That's another, obviously another story. But I think the following the money is a very good point. It should be said, quite apart from these arms deals, that since 9/11, the United States military budget, which on 9/11 was greater than the next 10 countries' military budgets combined, has doubled since September 11th, doubled. And it's now greater than just about every military budget on the planet combined. So the Chinese, the Russians, the French, the British, Saudis, Iranians, et cetera, you add them all together and the U.S. spends more money every year. The intelligence budget, so far as we know, has more than doubled. You know, and we're talking about tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars. And these have been a result of an attack by 19 people on the United States, representing a group that was then at most a few thousand people. So I think the response has been a kind of Cold War response, as if to start a new Cold War, in a response that was by no means, or an attack that was by no means similar or equivalent to the Soviet threat at all. I think it's way overblown. And that gets to a second point about propaganda. And I think, you know, the politics of fear are alive and well. Politicians know that fear is the most lucrative emotion. You see it. Donald Trump is highly aware of it, especially knowing that he is, as he says, the candidate of law and order, the candidate who will end ISIS. He has been Senator Claire McCaskill used this phrase, surfing fear for votes. And I think that relates directly to the point of the caller about propaganda, that in fact, you create this demon. I mean, there are terrorists. There's no question about it. But the idea that they're an existential threat to the country, I think, is wrong. But it's highly useful for many politicians to have that bogeyman to point to.
And Mark, what are your thoughts on the media, and is it afraid to say that what the U.S. continues to do is creating even more terrorists? Because we were talking about Yemen, and Sheila Carapico, who's been on this show before, she's a Yemen expert, was on KPFA recently and said for the very first time there's anti-American graffiti in Yemen. And it's because obviously people know that the United States weapons are being sold to Saudi Arabia that are being used to bomb infrastructure and kill people in Yemen. She said this has never been seen before in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question about the press and why the press can't point this out. I mean, in effect, the way the American press operates, someone prominent has to come. You know, if Colin Powell came forward and said, you know, our policy in the war on terror is simply creating more enemies. It's creating a perpetual war that's threatening us more and more. That would get covered, Colin Powell saying it. But someone prominent with national security credentials would have to take that position and say it publicly. And, you know, I think what you pointed to with Yemen is absolutely true. There is the sense in which incrementally the United States, since September 11th, has been creating enemies one by one. I mean, look at, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, the attacks of 9/11 were carried out by 19 people. They were representing perhaps 1,000 al-Qaeda. Today, you have not one international organization with terrorist franchises around the world, al-Qaeda, but you have two, the Islamic State, which is much, much larger and more influential and actually has territory in Iraq in Syria, spanning the Iraqi-Syria border. You also have, I mean, the number of jihadis has exploded. According to State Department figures, the year after 9/11, you had 732 worldwide terrorist attacks, according to the State Department. Last year, there were nearly 33,000. So the numbers have increased by 4,000%. So it's really hard to argue that the U.S. strategy is reducing terrorism. I mean, I think it's possible to argue that what the U.S. has done has protected Americans from being attacked. That's an argument that you can have and say the number of attacks on U.S. soil has been very few. This is because the United States has done what it's done. But in effect, if you are making that argument, you're saying that the strategy of striking out abroad is essentially allowing the creation of more terrorist attacks around the world in order to protect the United States. And, you know, this is not what our leaders are telling us our strategy is, because if they did say that, we would point to very obvious downsides to such a strategy. I mean, the Israelis call this strategy, when they use it in Gaza, mowing the grass, which is to say every couple of years they need to go into Gaza and kill a lot of people. You know, the grass has grown again. They've got to mow the grass. Mm. And the United States, in effect, around the world has adopted that strategy. And it has a very obvious downside, which we will see more and more in the years ahead, I think.
You do have a few people saying this. Former drone operators have said that drones create more terrorists. Retired Army mm-hmm. General Mike Flynn told Al Jazeera English last year that drones create more terrorists and the invasion of Iraq created ISIS. But this just doesn't seem to stick. It just doesn't seem to get in the, you know, the national conversation or repeated or have reporters ask presidential candidates about this. Why doesn't it stick?
Well, the fascinating thing is President Obama is on record as agreeing to it. I mean, one of the things I point out in Spiral is that President Obama is, on one hand, the exponent of this policy, the leader of it, and on the other hand, its leading critic. He has come forward and says this war must end. We cannot fight a perpetual war. This war, like all wars, must come to an end. I have a lot of those quotes in the book. And it's clear he's very torn about the expansion of the war that he has presided over. He's acted, you know, I take him at his word. I think he has acted in most cases to try to protect Americans. I think he is dug in his heels and tried to not get directly involved in Syria, even though we are involved there. But we would have been, had Hillary Clinton's opinion held sway or Leon Panetta's, we would be much more deeply involved now than we are in any event, in any case now. I think Obama is a kind of divided figure who at once is leading this policy and at the same time is highly doubtful about it. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about him, that he has found himself unable not to go forward, for example, with drones, that drones he clearly decided were the least bad option of many bad options. And, you know, he's probably killed 5,000 people with drones. It's a lot of people.
Well, Mark, again, thank you for coming on the show. We'd love to have you back to continue this conversation. Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. He's a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley and the author of several books, including his most recent, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Mark, thanks again. Have a good weekend.
Rose, thank you. I hope people will support KALW. I've loved being with you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that.